We have finished the first chapter, had only a couple lessons, but already finished the first chapter. Hope we're not going too fast, hope we're not going too slow. Hope that you'll feel perfectly free to raise your hand at any time with comments and questions of any type or kind. You know, we're all in this together. But we have finished the first chapter, so we'll do a tiny little bit of review before we head on in into chapter two. There is, I think, a really very clear outline in this first chapter. So if you've missed any classes, we'll go ahead and put it up on the screen here for you right now, a moment ago. Someone who had missed a previous class, he was asking me to help her get caught up, and we'll probably talk on the phone about that. And each week I'll try to do, you know, to some extent, this outlining so we'll begin to get it memorized. First things first, Solomon's got a purpose. He is not just speaking into the air. This is not something that's just taking place, you know, on the fly. He has decided to write a book. He sets out to tell us what the purpose of that book is in the first six verses. These chapters are all devoted to that proposition, which is what in the first six verses? To acquire wisdom in its many varied forms. And so we had a whole lot of different words that were used. You can scan down to the first six verses as I'm speaking right now and see every different which way that you could use the word wisdom in all of its different forms seems to appear in those first six verses. So Solomon's saying, I'm going to give you the depth and the breadth. I'm going to give you all there is to know really about wisdom, and it's going to be for both the young and for the old. But he starts, apparently, with the young. In verses 7 through 19, he tells us there are three steps to wisdom. What are they? Okay, fear the Lord. That's the beginning of wisdom. What comes next? Pay attention to your parents. And then? Stay away from sinners. A particular kind is in view here. They are the violent. Violent people, in particular, are singled out in most of those verses. Then, last week, we talked about verses 20 through 23, which is wisdom's call. Wisdom is portrayed as a woman. Wisdom is now going to go out everywhere so that there is no nook or cranny of the countryside that is not going to hear her calling to them to come and benefit from what she has to offer. So she shouts in the street, she lifts her voice in the square, she's at the head of the noisy street, she's crying out at the entrance of the gates, she's everywhere. And she's wondering, like we all do, we scratch our head sometimes and say, why do people do this? Why do people do these kinds of things? Dawn and I could have very easily been killed last time we came to the assembly here, I think it was. Well, it would have been a week ago. I guess it was a Wednesday night is what it was. You know, we were up on the Beltline, we were coming this way, we were doing the speed limit, 55 miles an hour, and all of a sudden the person in front of me slams on their brakes and comes all the way down to about 10 miles an hour so they can pull over immediately in front and bumper to bumper with a stalled car that apparently they've come to rescue on the shoulder. They don't park behind. They don't get off on this nice, long, mile-long shoulder and do all their slowing down over there. They do 55 till they're about 50 feet away, and then they roll on the brakes and pull over, and it was everything I could do to keep from rear-ending them. And I don't follow closely. So I ask myself, why do people do this? And there's wisdom out in the streets. The streets shouting at the top of her lungs, too. You know, why do people do this? And what she wants to know is, starting at verse 22, how long, O naive ones, will you love simplicity? And scoffers delight themselves in scoffing, and fools hate knowledge. How long? Well, brother, what is the answer to that question? As long as there's people. Okay. But it's kind of fun, isn't it, to see wisdom portrayed with the same sort of frustration that you and I all feel, too. Wisdom knows the answer. We know the answer. God knows the answer. Solomon knows the answer. That's why it's written in the book. The answer is, people will always be foolish. What we're trying to do as part of God's family is to play our role as Solomon was playing his right here. In turning back all of those who will. We know we're not going to turn to everybody. We know the way is straight and narrow. We know a few there are that find it. But we're going to try. We're not going to give up. We're going to be just like wisdom, aren't we? Everywhere. Now, you know how it is. Preachers hate to hear complaints. First thing I walk in the building today, I got a complaint. Lee comes up, she's all over me. She says, we're out of cards. How do I feel about that complaint? This is pretty cool. Got a complaint I can live with every night. So yes, I'm going to have to bring in some more cards. Now, you know, to be sure, there's whole lots of the cards for the church's address. She was talking about running out the ones, you know, for my personal address, because I didn't bring in as many of those as I did, you know, the others. I get you some more of those. But, you know, we'll keep you supplied. We just want to be exactly like wisdom. Here, there, and everywhere, so that, frustrating as it is, still yet, we never stop calling out to the naive ones to turn back from their foolishness and their simplicity. So there's a few verses about wisdom's call, and then you get a lot of verses that are wisdom's warning. Wisdom in verses 24 through 33 gets pretty stern, doesn't she? She says some really very harsh things. Now, before we get to that, though, in harsh as it is, let me ask you what the feel of this book is. In the early going, the early chapters, particularly I'll give the clue, in the first eight chapters, what is the sort of emotional appeal, if you will? What is the sense of the book? What kind of a relationship are we talking about? Okay, Carol?
He wants to give guidance to his son so that his son might live a long, prosperous life.
Okay, that's exactly it. What you have is a father advising a young and very apparently adult son. In chapters 1 through 8, you see in the smaller print at the bottom there, there's a total of 18 different times that either the exact expression, my son, or some variant thereof, is set forth as the basis of the appeal, or at least, you know, shows the heart that's behind that appeal. So never forget that. As you're reading the first 8 chapters, particularly, you're listening to a concerned parent who really loves his son, and all he's trying to do is to give him that sort of advice and all the admonition that he needs to succeed in life and to avoid all the very many problems, pitfalls, and dangers that are out there. So, okay, we finish that first chapter, but as I mentioned, how does it end? With this warning. Now, here's a summary of the things that were said in that warning last week. If you don't heed wisdom, then she will laugh and mock at your calamity when your dread comes. She will not answer you in the day of your distress. You will be left to your own devices, and fools will be destroyed and or killed. And that's no exaggeration. Those are the actual statements, again, as you scan down to the end of the chapter. It's fearsome. And so, like any good parent, who knows frequently that the advice he is giving is a matter of life and death, then there's great urgency here. Now, wisdom is portrayed as a woman. And there's a theme that's developing later we'll talk about in this case. God, as we'll see here in the verses we'll study tonight, is behind that wisdom, obviously. So Greg and I had a discussion, you all heard last week. He was very wise, very good Bible student, to point out that as I was just saying God, 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 it really didn't say God. All of this was in the mouth of wisdom. So we talked about that for a little while. Later on, we'll know, and of course you already knew the end from the beginning, that God is the fount of all wisdom. He's the source of all wisdom, so it's also God that's calling at the head of the strings there. And so these warnings come from God, now portrayed in the form of the woman, wisdom, portrayed as wisdom, who knows that life is tough and dangerous. It's bad out there. And parents, you don't get near enough years to get those kids ready for it now, do you? If they're not listening half the time anyway. And so Solomon is begging, pleading, you know, and sometimes warning very straightly, pay attention, it could even cost you your life. So now, new material, chapter 2. What happens next? We're going to break it down. But chapters 2 and the first 26 verses of chapter 3 are all really on just one topic. We're going to talk now about the benefits of wisdom, promises that wisdom is giving, If you will listen to her voice in the noisy streets and in the square and everywhere, if you'll pay attention to what she has to say, if you will heed Solomon's passionate advice, father to son, then there's a long list of really good things that'll come your way. It'll take us a couple of weeks to get through all of them. But if you're doing, you know, an outline of some kind, either on the pages of your Bible or just taking notes, this is the big heading, this is the top heading for quite a while to come. Chapter 2, verses 1 through chapter 3, 26, all about the promises that wisdom has to offer. And it begins like this. Okay? Brethren, there's only two ways, I believe, known to man, there's only two ways possible for you to actually get a thrill out of the carousel. What are they?
Standing up, sitting down.
Pardon me?
Standing up and sitting down.
Okay, well, good for you. There's two different ways. But if you get a spin that thing's what I'm looking for, my fault. What do you got to have? You got to have a motor. Either somebody's going to push it and you stand up or sit down and get flung off. I've seen that. Or you got to push it yourself. Otherwise, how much activity is there? There isn't any. And so here's this poor glum little kid, you know, sitting there. You know, sorry, really am. But wisdom, for all of her crying in the streets, listen to me, does not then just walk over like parents sometimes do with their kids, and they go something like this. You know, when you do that, do you get the child's attention? Sure. Do you impart any knowledge at all?
No.
They don't learn anything. They might wake up a little bit. They might figure out you're unhappy with them. But this wisdom does not come miraculously. If you want to ride the merry-go-round, brethren, then the first five verses of chapter 2 will tell you what price you have to pay. So, you get the benefits of wisdom, but first, my son, if you will receive my sayings and treasure my commandments within you, make your ear attentive to wisdom. Incline your heart to understanding. For if you cry for discernment, lift your voice for understanding. If you seek her as silver and search for her as for hidden treasures, then you will discern what? Don't say the fear of the Lord. You will discern what? What is the fear of the Lord? Fear of the Lord is the beginning, isn't it? It's the beginning. Whoa. Looks to me like he had to climb a high mountain just to get to the start. This must be special forces training or something here. So look at the list on the board here. It's, once again, I just put it all together for you. Receive the sayings, treasure the commandments in your heart, have an attentive ear, incline your heart, cry for discernment, lift your voice for understanding, seek that wisdom like silver, and search for it like treasure, then what will you get? Fear the Lord, which is the beginning of wisdom. So, brother, the next time somebody pulls to a stop out on your freeway, and you're going, like that, what is the answer to the question? How long are people going to do this? And what is the answer to that question? Why do people do such stupid things? What's the answer? Because, brethren, it takes a lot to get past that stage. It takes a whole lot. The serious effort. We are going to have to work on this, Ted. I'm going to continue watching here. And so I keep hearing the feedback and all that. We're going to have to watch out and figure out what that is. But anyway, brother, you know, look, that's a lot, isn't it? Are you doing that? Now, if you're here tonight, I'm sure you would say, yes, I received the sayings. You come to get them. Anybody here, you know, you doubt that. You do receive them. You do go to where you can get that information. And it's not just in these assemblies by any means. I know you read your Bibles. I know many of you are telling me about it, that you picked up these little challenges of mine. You're trying to read a Proverbs chapter every day. You're trying to read the chapter we'll be studying also once a week. So you're talking then, you know, about a lot of reading. That's about 8 chapters at least in the book of Proverbs. I recommend you do the same thing with the chapter we're studying the book of Acts, and I know that you're doing it. You're receiving those things. But then, you know, the next one was to treasure commandments in your heart. Well, we're having so much fun on the freeway today. You got this black and white sign that says 55 on it. How much time have you spent treasuring that commandment? Sounds stupid, doesn't it? Why don't you ever think about it? I know it's kind of understand what's going on with it. Really, that might be so for a speed limit. You read a commandment that says, pick one. Anybody, give me one. Thou shalt not.
Be angry and do not sin.
Say again?
Be angry and do not sin.
Be angry and do not sin. There's a commandment for you. And give you a little advice for Larry on the freeway. Okay. So, yeah. A commandment like that deserves what from your heart? It deserves an investment. It deserves some thought.
Consideration.
Yes. And especially when you use the word treasure, what's the idea?
Guard it.
High value, right? That is a precious statement. I want to treasure that in my heart. I want that statement to be something that I really value highly. I appreciate it. I think about it. I like it. I love it. You know, I'm paying attention. Now, the next one is an attentive ear and an inclined heart. Now, again, the Proverbs, I think you all know this, you have these couplets, and so they're paired up, and it's a different way of saying the same thing. And yet, in each case, it really is, you know, a slight difference, at least in the figure that's given, as well, I think, as in the idea that figure represents. So, if you have there an attentive ear, what kind of an ear is that? That is an ear. It's an ear that hears. Back here, Faye.
Focused.
Exactly that. An attentive ear. Okay? Now, an attentive ear, is that a divided ear? Is that an ear that's paying attention to 6, you know, different things at once? How many of you guys have heard about multitasking? And you probably already knew this in your heart of hearts, but I've been reading in more than one article now about the complete myth of multitasking and how we have all been, because for many years, you know, multitasking was just the thing we were all supposed to strive for, you know, and we were going to buy enough devices, we'd be able to do it better, you know, and all that kind of stuff. The simple fact of the matter is, you know, the research comes out now and they're saying, well, you know, sorry, Charlie, but you have to pay attention. You have to focus. You have only so many mental resources. And if you're trying to scatter yourself between a video source that's on the news and an audio source that's for entertainment while you're answering questions from your teacher, you know, you're not going to be multitasking well. You will be poorly tasking many different things because you're just stealing resources from all of them. So, you know, finally, I think common sense won out, you know, and the science is saying the same thing. No. An attentive ear is one that is locked on to this and not distracted by a bunch of other things. What is an inclined heart?
Inclination.
Carol came up to me on Sunday and she says, did you know... She didn't use these words, but what she pointed out was, my shoulders are inclined. Did you notice that? This one's lower by 2 inches than the other one. I don't know how that happened. But most of the time when I think I'm standing straight, I really not. I've tilted over on that side. Then we laughed about it because she told her, yeah, you know, all my life I've always carried my briefcase, weighs about 10 or 15 pounds, all the books I carry, you know, on this side, and probably built this side up, you know, as well. She's like, oh, this all the time. This side needs to get more books. inclined. It's not an angle, isn't it? It's not straight. It's tilted. Your heart is supposed to be tilted. Yes. My mom, from birth, only had one good ear. So, what did I watch her do all my life? She was always inclining.
I forget which ear it is now. You know, I didn't wait for too long.
That's what it is. It's a physical way of saying you blot out all the other stuff and you pay attention to this. Okay? Then cry for discernment and lift your voice for understanding. Give me a different word than cry or lift your voice.
Pray.
You're supposed to be praying about this. Did James say something like that? Brethren, wisdom's yours for the what? For the asking. But it depends on the ask. And then you seek her like what? Search for her like treasure. Silver and treasure are things that are very, very valuable. And when people want that, then they're looking for silver. If you are looking for silver, are you a fisherman? They're looking for fish. Silver guys aren't out on boats. They're out, you know, wherever people want their silver. I don't know. You got some silver smiths out here. But, brethren, now I wish it wasn't so. Wouldn't it be great if the merry-go-round just propelled itself? Wouldn't it be great if God just went, and oh, you know, I see it. Wouldn't it be great if, you know, the big krill mind machine in Forbidden Planet was actually real, and you could just go down and put on a big silver hat and, you know, and you'd know everything. Wouldn't that be great? But it doesn't work that way, does it? So what? So he says in four verses to get down to verse 5, then you will discern the fear of the Lord and discover the knowledge of God. But brethren, the fear of the Lord and the knowledge of God is predicated, is dependent, is contingent on that list in four verses. That's what gets the motor turning, or is the motor that gets the wheel turning. So, you know, sure, I guess I could wish it wasn't so, but it is. Then, a contingency, you'll discern the fear and discover the knowledge. Now, chapter 2 continues. Verses 6 through 10 gives you your first benefit of wisdom. You get your first sign that you have a promise now that's going to be made as wisdom's crying out in the streets and she's going to offer all of this. After her warning, we get to verse 6. The Lord gives wisdom. From His mouth come knowledge and understanding. He stores up sound wisdom for the upright. He is a shield to those who walk in integrity, guarding the paths of justice, and He preserves the way of His godly ones. Then you will discern righteousness and justice and equity and every good course. For wisdom will enter your heart, and knowledge will be pleasant to your soul. Now, there's really kind of two things that are involved in this, and I only put the one up, you know, God is a shield. But let's see if you can dig now and tell me what kind of lies behind that. What is the point of verses 6 and following? It's directly related to the first 5 verses. Yes, it says, as you get a little bit later there, that God is a shield, and He'll guard your paths and all of that. But that's a fact. What are these verses, 6 through 10, saying? Something different. That God takes care of dumb people, I think is the way it was put, right? Okay. But that's it. Not the words I would use, you know, to get to the point. See, what it says, the source is whom? The source is God. Now, what were the first 5 verses about? all this effort that you were going to put in? Okay? And then what does verse 6 start with? What's the first word in verse 6? F-O-R, for the Lord gives wisdom. From His mouth come knowledge and understanding. He stores up sound wisdom for the upright. He's a shield, etc. Well, all those things we had up here in this corner from verses 1 through 5, all that hard work you had to do to get the carousel moving, okay, you've got to do all of that. For the Lord gives wisdom. It is His response to your activity in the first 5 verses. Now, brethren, God is a really good parent. Parents often get just really swept away by their love for their children. And they do terrible harm to their kids as a result. Because they get so caught up in the love for their children that they really have a hard time asking them to do chores or expecting them to get, you know, better grades or pressing them here, there, everywhere, or especially, you know, meeting out that punishment when they have committed some infraction of the rules. It's really easy for parents to just love their kids to death. I mean, the death of the child, as Proverbs will tell us, you know, in the future. Is God like that? Not after you read the first chapter, right? And wisdom gave that long warning. God is constantly expecting His people to really work out. He is really making them sweat. He is a great parent who has all sorts of chores and responsibilities and goals and expectations. If they're not met, you pay a price for it. He's got a program in place. And when you get up and you get involved and you do all the things that He asks, then you get to square one. You discern the fear of the Lord. And you come then to square two, wisdom, which is, you know, the beginning of it is the fear. Now you acquire some wisdom, and now we are told, God then therefore will be a shield to you. What does that verse necessarily say? If you don't, then what? God is no shield. And what were all those verses at the end of chapter 1, about half the chapter, all about? I will not be there. I will not respond when you pray, when you need me. I will laugh at you if you have not responded to my wisdom. So this point is still being made, even though we've very clearly passed into this section that's dealing with these benefits of wisdom. They're still contingent upon us doing something. Now verses 11 through 15. Discretion will guard you. Understanding will watch over you to deliver you from the way of evil, from the man who speaks perverse things, from those who leave the paths of uprightness to walk in the ways of darkness, who delight in doing evil and rejoice in the perversity of evil, whose paths are crooked and who are devious in their ways. Now, I'm going to stop there because you can see that's what I did on the board. But look at verse 16. Then it says, to deliver you what? From the strange woman. So you should group these verses somehow. There isn't any doubt that verses 11 through 15 are completely devoted to rescuing, protecting you from evil men. Then, look at the other side of the chart in verses 16 and following. But he's distinguished them, and we want to pick up on that too. So as Solomon speaks to his son then, he has told him, God will guard you. Verse 9, you'll discern righteousness and justice and equity in every good course. Wisdom will enter your heart. Knowledge will be pleasant to your soul for a reason. Discretion will guard you, understanding will watch over you to deliver you from the way of evil, from the man who speaks perverse things, from those who leave the paths of uprightness to walk in the ways of darkness, etc. So, this loving father Solomon, the wisest man on earth, is saying to his son, son, there are bad men out there, real bad men. They will function in a variety of different ways. You can be deceived, you can be enticed, you will be allured by the things that they have to offer. You can prevent great disaster, and God will be a shield to protect you from Him if you have paid attention to those first 5 verses in chapter 2. If you've understood that warning at the end of chapter 1. If you've been listening to wisdom in the middle of chapter 1. If you follow these three steps to wisdom that I told you about, and if you read the first six verses of chapter 1, you understand you'll be spending the rest of your life reading this book. Then, evil men, they will not be a problem for you. Now, brothers, whenever God goes to such great lengths as to give us all this information, then shouldn't we stand back and ask ourselves why and maybe realize these evil men are a major problem, aren't they? They are not to be taken lightly. I've had a chapter and five verses to prepare me for all that God is willing to do, trying to help us to understand. You need to avoid those guys. And look at all that has to happen if you're going to get that job done. Michael, it says these evil men will pillage your treasure if you're not protecting it. That's exactly what this is all about. So, by the way, Fort Knox, can you just walk up to the front door and knock on it and you'll say, I need a five? What happens? That's what gardening is about. I missed that one now. I gotta hear that. You saw? Yeah. There's a treasure in there. That thing has to be guarded. And so we're learning by the extensive list of things that God is saying here. And about then, this major amount of activity that we're going to have to show the Lord in order for Him to respond by giving us these things. That this is a hard thing. It's dangerous. It takes a lot of effort or it's not going to happen. Now, we can go piece by piece here, and we probably shouldn't. In fact, I do. I just feel like I'm going so fast because I didn't say anything even about verses 9 and 10. So let's just read those again because sometimes it will be hard, and this is one of those places to draw a hard line and say, well, these verses are talking about that, and the next verse are talking about that. It does flow together, and it overlaps quite a bit. So in this case, let's back up to verse 9 before we get to these evil men. Then you will discern righteousness and justice. What did that just tell you? If you have to discern it, then what? It's somehow obscured, isn't it? It's in a fog or something, or it's in the forest, it's in the darkness. There's something about this, it's hard to recognize. Righteousness and justice need to be discerned. And equity and every good course, they do too. What is fair and just, equity, and what is good and right, the course that you ought to take, these things are not often readily discerned. To be distinguished and recognized, you need help. Then in verse 10 it says, these things will come to you though, and in verse 10, for wisdom will enter your heart, and knowledge will be pleasant to your soul. What's that tell you about knowledge? If it says, then knowledge will be pleasant to your soul, what would you infer from that statement? Yes, you have learned something, but then knowledge will be pleasant. Okay? Yes, that's really close. Okay, over here. Have to apply it. You're all hitting around it. I feel like I'm dialing in mortar fire.
Usually in computer code, it's called an if-then statement.
Yes?
So, if you do this, then that will happen. But the then doesn't happen unless the if happens first.
Yes. And again, you're all right at it. But the key word nobody's mentioned yet. Is knowledge pleasant just automatically in and of itself?
No.
No! What is Solomon going to say in the book of Ecclesiastes about the making of many books?
There's no end to it.
Yeah, and it is a weariness to the soul. Okay? All right? Now, I know you're in a college town, so it's probably a little bit different here. Okay? You're going to find people in this town who probably do find knowledge pleasant. That's why they come to school. Okay? But do most folks, and is it naturally so? I guess my question would be, if you go down to Barnes & Noble and ask them, do they sell more books on mathematics, you know, or John Grisham novels, you know, which is it going to be? See, if you want entertainment, well, everybody wants that. But knowledge and wisdom and discernment, you have to seek it like silver, which is not just lying everywhere, right? Like treasure. You have to go hunt for this. So, again, learn, brethren. I think it's one of the, you know, just kind of classic principles of Bible study or any study is to look at a passage and then negate it to see what it means if you put the negative in there. Okay? And in that manner, you will often pick something up because now you've been treasuring it in your heart. You've been mulling it over. And something, you know, a different aspect or slant of it will appear. So what I was digging for right there is that in verse 10, wisdom will enter your heart and knowledge will be pleasant to your soul. Most people, when wisdom smacks their forehead and says, how long are they going to do this? You know, most people are not interested in knowledge because it isn't pleasant at first. You develop a taste for it. The more effort you expend, the more time that you put in, the tastier that it becomes. The more familiar with it, so you see the fruits that it produces, then the more delightful that it is to you. Why do you plant a garden? Why do you tend it? Why do you fertilize it? Why do you weed it? Why do you prune it? Why do you do all of that? Do you like the fruit? Right? You developed a taste for it. And now you're willing to put in a whole lot of work. Because it's really pleasant. Okay? But when you're being a wise parent, you've got the kids at home, you tell them to go out and do tend the yard. How do they do that? Meanest person that ever lived. They don't have a taste for it. Knowledge is that way, brethren. That is, God's knowledge is that way. Okay, so, verse 10, wisdom will enter your heart, knowledge will be pleasant to your soul, discretion will guard you, understanding will watch over you. Now, on the screen here, I found this great, you know, warrior here. That's discretion. That's understanding. What is guarding you in those two lines? Yes, it's God. Yes, it's wisdom. But what is it? What's the form that it takes? You developed a taste for these things. You sought for them and you found them. You incorporated them in your life. And now, the discretion that you acquired because of all the effort you put in to spin the merry-go-round guards you. And that understanding will watch over you. A lot of effort went in to producing that kind of a soldier, and you are the one that put in the effort. Verse 12, to deliver you from the way of evil, from the man who speaks perverse things, from those who leave the paths of uprightness, to walk in the ways of darkness, who delight in doing evil and rejoice in the perversity of evil, whose paths are crooked and who are devious in their ways. Have we read about those guys in this book before? They were in which step? Step 3. Avoid these guys if you would acquire the scriptures as the beginning of wisdom and then the wisdom itself. So, we've got only 15 minutes left. Here's a hand. Yes, Carol?
Tailgate brings the pleasure.
way, it's been amazing, you know, off the subject a little bit, it's really amazing how driving is inherited from the people you're around. So that if you go to Los Angeles, they drive differently than they do here. And it's very readily recognizable. And if you go to Seattle, there's a different way they drive there. And I came down here to Eugene immediately, and I recognize it. But I've got to start making some adjustments here. Because this town has certain protocols that people have all picked up from everybody else. I'm hoping that was not one of them. But, you know, back to what Carol was saying now, it's exactly right, brethren. Why do most people have accidents? By the way, you know what is the number one cause of accidents? I taught driver's ed for 3 years. It's failure to yield. I'm not going to go into all of that because that meant a lot. But there's one form of failure to yield that causes more accidents than anything else. What's that? Carol just mentioned it.
Tailgating.
That's the number one cause of accidents. It's what does it most. And they said, well, drinking does it. Yeah, but because they were drinking, what were they doing? They were tailgating. So alcohol is involved in 50% of all those fatalities, but it's because people fail to drink because they were tailgating. Okay? So if you program yourself so that, now let me ask you this way. This is directly related to what we're doing right here. Brethren, is it possible to be 100% fully involved and undistracted in your driving at all times?
No.
That is not humanly possible. It's not possible. So, earlier this afternoon, I was coming the other way on the Beltline, and I looked up ahead. I just got on, and I looked up ahead, and I see now at the next on-ramp, there's a fire truck coming with all his lights on. So a guy pulled in, you know, in front of me. Now, we live out here close to the expressway, so when I got to the Northwest Expressway off-ramp, I noticed that he was getting off. You know what else I noticed? There was a car coming the other direction, eastbound, the other side of the freeway, fully down into the ditch. And three people had climbed up out of the ditch and they were standing there, you know, and obviously he was going to get off just so he could turn around, you know, and come back to them. Now, I'm sailing down the freeway, I'm being alert, I'm not tailgating, I see the guy, you know, and I have him going all the rest of that, but what happened? Well, now the corner of my eye glanced over there and I saw those people in the ditch. You can't stop yourself. Who can do that? You can't just go, I can't make this one down here. You can't. So, if you train yourself, though, to always stay back as far as you really should, then when you get distracted and you turn to look at the accident on the other side, and the guy up front hits the brakes because he wants to pull over and give somebody a jump start, then what? You got plenty of space. But if you're the kind of person who's thoughtless all the time, you drift on up and you're really close. In other words, brethren, if you live your life in the danger zone at all times, when you get distracted, then what? Danger. And now there's no time. There's no buffer. There's no space. Carol nailed it. What God is trying to do with our characters, I have a whole sermon on habits. And that's what this is all about. Is now in every aspect of my life, just like with driving, I'm going to give myself a buffer. I've got a perimeter. Now then, even when I'm distracted, when stuff is going on, I have a safety zone here. So that I'm far less likely to crash into some kind of a problem. Satan's less likely to get a hold of me because I kept myself a wide perimeter. I made my safety zone as big as it could get. That's what the book of Proverbs is all about. But as we've seen, it takes an awful lot of effort. When you do it, who's protecting you? Look on the screen. Who is that? Somebody shout loud. One answer. What would one answer be? Who's protecting you?
Wisdom.
Wisdom's protecting you. Who else is protecting you? God is protecting you. Who else is protecting you? Christ? Is that what you said?
Discretion.
Okay. And in the third one, who's that? That's you. See, all these things are working together. Now, I'm down to 10 minutes, and that's perfect. It's exactly what I needed. Let's go for the next few minutes on verses 16 through 19. I just want to finish the second chapter. So, in 16, to deliver you from the strange woman, from the adulteress, who flatters
with her words, then leaves the companion of her youth, forgets the covenant of her God, for her house sinks down to death, and her tracks lead to the dead. None who go to her return again, nor do they reach the paths of life. So you will walk in the way of good men, and keep to the paths of righteousness. And the upright will live in the land, and the blameless will remain in it, but the wicked will be cut off from the land, and the treacherous will be uprooted from it. Verses 16 through 19 are all speaking, though, about being protected, being guarded from what? The evil woman. Okay? Now, most of you have probably heard this before. The word is strange. It's strange woman. What does that mean? The strange woman. Yes. Exactly. It doesn't mean she's weird. It doesn't mean she's odd. It means that she's strange to you. And it's supposed to stay that way. Estranged. It's the way it ought to be. See, the problem is, if you don't keep it that way, you're not delivered from it. Now she's not strange anymore. Now you know her. That wasn't supposed to happen. So, if you want to be delivered from that strange woman, if you want to keep that relationship the way it belongs, strange, separate, you know, apart, then you need all the things he's been talking about, chapter 1 and chapter 2. Okay, we'll do it at some time and not right away, because it comes up again later. But just so you know, there's a lot of verses about evil women in the book of Proverbs. Now, I'll have to print this up for you. It's all written in my Bible, my notes, so I'll just read it to you tonight, and then next class I'll try to get this printed out for you. There are 63 verses in the book of Proverbs, and that is 6.8% of the book, by verses, that portray wisdom as a good woman. That's food for thought, something to treasure in your heart. 6.8% of the book of Proverbs is wisdom being portrayed as a good woman. Okay? 3% of this book is on good women. That's another 3% of the book is about good women. Proverbs 31. 28 verses in the book are devoted to good women. 9.3% of the book is devoted to bad women. Okay, there are 915 verses in the whole book. I had to write that down in first class. There's 85 verses on bad women. That's 9.3% of the book is on bad women. Brother, when you got nearly 10% of anything, you got a lot of it. That ought to make us open our eyes. Wow. Solomon spends a lot of time on this, and so it must not be very important then, huh? Or maybe it's way more important than I thought. Wonder if I'm devoting the kind of time to it I should. Yep.
It's interesting you should mention that because the last chapter of the book is on what a good woman is.
So how did the book of Proverbs start off? Wisdom as a... How does it end up? With good woman, as Bill just pointed out. That's just curious. You know, stuff that you start finding as you're working with the book. Now, I will also give you the verses, and not now, I've already given you the numbers, but that is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. There are 9 major sections of the book that are dealing with adultery, just adultery itself. Now, it's going to involve an evil woman, you know, an evil man, but that's a lot of material. And then you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 places usually that are, you know, just single verses though not all, you know, that are on a bad woman / wife though. It's really dealing, you know, with a married woman who is a bad woman. Which all just adds up, you know, to say there's a lot of women in the book of Proverbs. So this may be Solomon teaching his son. True enough. Boys need to learn about this. Okay? So let's spend a lot of time on it. But at the same time, what are you learning? Women. And the women are learning what it is to be a bad woman and how to avoid that too. So it's still going to work both ways. Solomon's going to get both of those things done. Now, that's it. With 5 minutes to go, it's exactly perfect. Really appreciate your feedback because we're getting a lot of it tonight. I want to encourage that. And you see, it still fits the time frame, you know, the plan here, the class plan. So I don't hesitate. And we'll close off with these last three verses, 20, 21, and 22. So you will walk in the way of good men and keep to the paths of righteousness. For the upright will live in the land, and the blameless will remain in it. But the wicked will be cut off from the land, and the treacherous will be uprooted from it. Now, I want you to think about that land for a minute. Who's writing this section of the book? Solomon. How does he identify himself in the early going of the book of Ecclesiastes? He was the preacher who was king, wasn't he? Okay. What land is he talking about? Is he talking about Alaska? No. The land he's thinking of, the land he's talking about, would be what land? It's the land of Israel. He's the king over that land. Now, all this is going to work, brethren, wherever you live, because many verses are going to talk about just protecting your life and not getting killed by foolishness. Okay, so it's true to keep you alive, you know, you'll live on the land. But never forget that this is a king talking to his son about life in, you know, the land that God had given them, flowing with milk and honey, and was currently at its highest and happiest state. During Solomon's reign, they didn't have all the wars going on that David had to contend with. They were immensely wealthy. Solomon was the wise and good king, you know, and so you had great government going on. And so Israel was never in all their existence in such a happy state as they were under King Solomon. And when he says, then you'll be able to stay in the land, you'll be able to dwell in the land, what might the king just might have in his mind for his son? Invasion from foreign countries, taking us off into captivity. This is not far from the king's mind ever. He is saying, do this, and you will preserve the entire kingdom. Do this, and you will live long and prosper. Okay? In the land of Israel, in the kingdom of God, in this great promised place, where at that moment, they never had it better, and they never would again. Because Rehoboam would prove to be a foolish son. He would immediately tear the kingdom apart. And then, what would happen? It would be divided. They would go to war, the civil wars, back and forth. People would lose their property, their invasions from all these other countries as well. So nothing but problems. So, brethren, there's a pretty big picture, I think, here. In the book of Proverbs, as the king astride the best kingdom that Israel would ever be, saying, do not jeopardize it. Now, close with this, just because it's an election season. It's important to vote, and everybody ought to vote. But is that what preserves a land? What preserves a land? Righteousness and righteousness and wisdom. So, if you want to have influence over this land, our land today, greater than voting, what do you become? You become righteous and wise, and you infect the world with it. Then, there'll be fewer fools on the freeway.
There's a practical side there. But
any comment or question? Anybody? 1 minute. 30 seconds. Take it. Time's up. Okay?